Welcome to the La Trobe University podcast. I'd be your host, Matt Smith, and I'm here with Dr. Evan Kidd. Evan, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
How would you be?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. So you've been studying children with imaginary friends. You work in the School of Psychological Science.
Yeah, that's right.
Why have you been studying kids with imaginary friends?
Kids with imaginary friends are, by definition, kids who engage in lots of what we call symbolic play or pretend play. And psychologists have known for quite some time that kids who engage in lots of pretend play see the benefits in things like their language development and other types of development that is kind of what you consider important for success at things like school. So given my interest in pretend play, I thought, well, you know, it's a logical next step to look at these kids who engage in lots of it, which are kids with imaginary companions.
What about pretend play interests you?
Well, pretend play is interesting because common sense tells us that it's just something that kids do. Kids pretend they have imaginations and kids play. But like I said, what we've found is that kids, or what lots of people have found, is that it's actually a really important part of development, an essential part of development, and is linked to things like children's linguistic development.
So have you found that children with imaginary friends have better developed language skills? Or?
Yeah, we found something a little bit more subtle than that. So what we found is that kids who have imaginary companions are really good in conversation with adults. So what they do is, what they're able to do is understand the information that when they're talking to an adult that the adult needs to know, and they provide that information in an efficient manner.
Why do children come up with imaginary friends? What prompts them to develop these sort of things?
Well, these kids are just generally very creative in the beginning.
Yeah.
Kids who have imaginary companions or imaginary friends tend to be only children or firstborn children. It's not solely a phenomenon that's limited to only children or firstborn children, but if you are an only child or firstborn, you're more likely to develop one. And what we think is that because these kids are creative and because they've got more opportunities for what you'd call lone play, for instance, because they've got no brothers and sisters to play with, they've got more opportunities to be by themselves. And so in the absence of being able to play with, for instance, brothers and sisters, they invent people to play with.
Is it a lack of stimulus in their environment?
I wouldn't say that. Kids just have a natural tendency or a natural drive to play anyway. They want to keep themselves interested in things. So it's not as though they don't have enough toys, I guess, or something like that. It's just this is something that they really enjoy doing, so why not do it?
At what point does a child, say, grow out of an imaginary friend? Is there a point where they don't need them anymore?
Yeah, they tend to hit their height of popularity at about 4 or 5. Kids can have them as early as 2. That's what we think, that they, about 4 or 5, they're really popular, or most children will have them at that point if they're going to have them. And then what happens is kids hit primary school and they develop a larger peer group, so there's less opportunity to engage in this kind of lone play where they would play with their imaginary companion. But what I found since talking to a lot of people after this story gained a bit of popularity is that lots of kids aged 8 or 9 tend to have them still. So it could be that we're just not targeting that age group, and that kids at this age do tend to have them and they still play with them.
Did you have an imaginary friend when you were younger?
No, I didn't. As I said, kids generally have them with their firstborn or only children. I was secondborn in a large sort of family. So
there's no Pete's dragon for you.
No, unfortunately not.
You said that they tend to be able to communicate better with adults,
yeah,
to get their thoughts across. How is that extending to, say, their school development?
Yeah, well, the thing is, I guess I said that they interact better with adults because that's what we tested them in that kind of situation. Mm. If we could, you know, it would be nice to do the study again and test them with peers, because I would imagine that they would perform better than kids without imaginary companions, given the same situation, but talking to a peer. If we take the research into the classroom, I think that the actual task that we tested them on, and this is kind of a task where the kids had to explain something to an adult in an unambiguous manner and an efficient manner, then I guess this is the kind of problem that happens in the classroom all the time. What kids have to do a lot in the classroom is understand how language can be ambiguous, for instance, and they have to understand instructions and also potentially express themselves to a teacher if they don't understand some things.
There's kind of two schools of thought that you can go down with a child who has an imaginary friend. One is that kids will be kids, just let them have their fun, and the other is that maybe it's a sign of a developmental drawback of some sort, or you know, the child's having trouble adjusting to things, so that they're relying on an imaginary friend. Which sort of train of thought do you tend to follow on that?
That's a really complex question, and I guess it comes back to the fact that the kids invent imaginary companions for a whole myriad of reasons.
Mm.
So I would say that the majority of kids who invent imaginary companions are just doing so because, like I said, they enjoy playing, they're creative, and that's what they do. But there are cases in the literature where kids do invent them for in sort of difficult transitional periods. So for instance, parents could be going through a divorce, or they could be moving, and when signs of stress occur, children, what children tend to do is try and play out these types of their worries and fears through pretend play. And this is one of the functions of pretend play. So it could be that an imaginary companion might appear during these times, but this doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad thing. It just means that the kids are trying to explore the emotions and what's going on around them.
So how did you go about your testing? You had a sample area of children, a sample number of children. Did you talk to the imaginary friends through the children at all?
No. One of the nice things about doing this research is that you get to hear all the great stories about the kids' imaginary friends, but kids don't often bring them into the lab, so you can't guarantee that the imaginary friend or friends, as it might be, will come into the lab. So you have to just take it on authority that they've got them. They might tell you about them, but sometimes they're very private things for the kids. They're their own friend, and it's their own fantasy, and they're not really interested in sharing it with other people. So unfortunately, you don't often get to talk to the imaginary friend.
Oh, that would have been really interesting to try and pick the imaginary friend's brain a bit. What sort of imagination did the kids display? What sort of imaginary friends did they tell you about?
Well, like I said, this is the fun part of doing this research. So we have loads of different ones, and that really the imaginary friends are reflections of the fantastic variety of imaginations that the kids have. So we had things like imaginary dogs, and we had one child had an imaginary friend that was named after a Bon Jovi lyric. The lyric was "Shot Through the Heart," and I think it's "You Give Love a Bad Name."
You Give Love a Bad Name,
After I sort of heard this, I asked the mother if she was a Bon Jovi fan, and she admitted to it reluctantly. There was one child who in particular was quite funny. He just didn't have an imaginary friend. He had an imaginary world and a microcosm. And he had an imaginary wife, an imaginary baby. His wife wasn't the mother of his baby. It was a nurse who traveled internationally. And when he was in the lab, his mum asked him about his imaginary wife, and he turned to her and said, "Oh, I don't have her anymore. I divorced her because she spoke too much." So that's definitely my favourite one.
Because that's an imaginary sitcom in the making.
Yeah, that's right. So like I said, the variety that you see give you a flavour of what these imaginary lives are like, and they're massively varied and quite fantastic.
Well. So how did you go about sampling these children?
What we did was, this research was done when I was working at the University of Manchester, and we had a big database of families, and we sent letters out to the parents who had children in our age range. We were sending them out to kids from about 4 to 6, to families who had kids from around 4 to 6, and we just sent out a letter saying, you know, we're doing this study on imaginary friends. Does your child have one? If so, would you like to bring them in? Imaginary friends are really popular, really common in a child's development. I think its current estimates are up to 65% of children should have one at one point in development. So we expected a pretty big return rate, and we expected to see quite a few of these kids, but we didn't actually get many responses. And the responses that we got were from parents who were quite concerned about it, who were concerned that maybe this was a sign of mental illness
something
like that. And so then, after speaking to these parents, we decided to send out letters to the same parents again, but tell them a little bit about how good it is to have one. And then suddenly we got flooded with parents putting their hands up to let their kids be in the study. So I guess what that showed was that there's a lot of
stigma attached to
a lot of misinformation, I guess, often in the media or in films. Imaginary companions are depicted as kind of signs of mental illness or of loneliness, and what we're trying to do is really dispel that.
Well, the only one that comes to mind, unfortunately, is Drop Dead Fred.
Yes,
unfortunately.
And I think Donnie Darko, in Donnie Darko, Jake Gyllenhaal's character, he has a character that visits him in his dreams, and it's quite spooky and quite scary.
Yeah.
Hopefully, as part of this research, or the outcome of this research, is that we'll be able to dispel some of these myths.
Was that your intention going into the research? Or?
No, it wasn't. Like I said, we had this interest in play, and we wanted to see whether or not playing a lot with an imaginary companion can be linked to beneficial aspects of communication. We didn't really anticipate that people would have this idea about or a stigma, like you said, about imaginary companions. But we did find that. But hopefully now we've righted some of those wrongs.
So what's your next step in your research?
What we're doing at the moment with one of my PhD students is we're looking at kids who are older, so primary school age kids, to see whether or not they've got imaginary companions at the same sort of level as we expect to find them in children who are preschool. And we generally have found almost a similar percentage in those kids, but we're also giving them real tests of creativity and multiple tests of creativity to see if we can quantify how creative these kids actually are in comparison to same age peers who don't have imaginary friends.
Okay, so hopefully you'll be able to see a real sort of tangible benefit to having imaginary friends.
Yeah, and also we'll learn a bit more about it, like we were talking about. Sometimes there's stigma attached to this, and what we'd like to show is that this is a completely normal phenomenon in development, and it's nothing to worry about. In fact, it might be something to celebrate.
Okay. Dr. Evan Kidd, thank you for your time today.
Thanks.